Last week,
while we weren't here, the ruler of Egypt turned out to be Yosef, and many things have happened, and we find ourselves in the final parsha of Bereishis, Parshas Vayechi. And in the beginning of the parsha, Yaakov takes the step of promoting, so to speak, two of Yosef's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, to become Shvatim. And let's take a look at the background to that. That's in Perek Mem Ches, Pasuk Gimel. So Yaakov calls Yosef to him. Pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Yaakov al Yosef, Kel Shakai, Nir'o Eilai Beluz Be'eretz Kanan. Hashem appeared to me in Luz, in Eretz Kanan. Vayavarech Osi, he blessed me. What did he say? Vayomer Eilai, Hineni Marfechovi Hibisicha, I will increase you. Unisaticha Lekalamim, you will become an assembly of nations. Benosati Esa'aretz Hazos Lazarcha Acharecha Achuzas Olam. And this land, Eretz Kanan, will become an everlasting holding, inheritance for your descendants. Okay. Next, Pasukei Va'ata. And now, Shnevonecha Hanoladim Lecha Be'eretz Mitzrayim. Your two sons who were born to you in Mitzrayim, Ad Bo'yelecha Mitzrayim Olihem, before I came to you, they are to me, Ephraim and Manasseh, Kiruvin V'Shimon Yiyuli. Ephraim and Manasseh, they are like Reuven and Shimon, they're like Shvatim. So of course, in a sense, the most important word to consider here is the opening word of Pasuk Hey, Va'ata, and now. Because that word has a connotation of given what we have just said, and now, based on the above, the following will happen. The question is, how do Psukim Gimel and Dalet, Hashem blessed me, and he said that I would have a multitude of descendants, and would get Eretz Canaan, how does that translate practically into, and the upshot of that is, your two sons are like my two sons. How does A lead to B? That is the question. Interestingly, and I would like to be guided here, for us to be guided by the great Reb Leib Hyman Zatzal, the Rav of the Groshel and Beit Vegan. He has some volumes on the Chumash, and what we are about to see is very simply a tour de force of Parshanut. Yaakov says that Hashem appeared to me in Luz. Where is Luz? Commonly known to us as Beit El. Now, and bless me, the truth is that Hashem appeared to Yaakov twice in Luz and blessed him. Meaning there were two separate occasions where Hashem gave Yaakov brachos in Luz, in Beit El. The first, when he left Eretz Kanaan to go to Lavan, and the second, when he came back. The first, in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, his famous dream with the ladder, was in Luz. And secondly, in Parshas Vayishlach. Now, the question, of course, that we will need to ask, the first question is, to which of these brachos, to which of these occasions is Yaakov referring to? The first, when he left, or the second, when he came back? Well, if we take a look at those two episodes, the answer will be quite clear for us. In the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, let's Na'aneh al Rishon Rishon, let's have a look at the first one first, and that's in Perek Kavches, Pasuk Yud Gimel. And here we need to pay attention to detail in order to be clear as to what will happen. So Perek Kavches, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Well, V'inei Hashem nitzav alav, this is the ladder, Malachei Elokim, Olim v'yordim bo, Hashem is standing over him, v'yomar, Ani Hashem, Elokei Abraham avicha, v'elokei Yitzhak, ha'aretz, asher ata shochev aleha, lecha etnena uluzarecha. So Yaakov here is promised the land, and, posuk yudaladen, v'yazarecha ka'afah ha'aretz, your descendants will be innumerable, like the dust of the land, ufaratzta yama v'akedma, v'tzafona banegba. So, in this bracha, as Yaakov leaves Eretz Canaan, He's promised the land. He's promised many descendants. Is this the bracha that he's referring to? Well, let's consult the second episode. That's in Parshas Vayishlach, when he comes back in Bereishis Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk Yud Aleph. And I think the answer will be quite clear to us. Pasuk Yud Aleph, this is again in Luz. Vayomer lo Elokim, ani kel shakai, perei urevei, goy ukal goyim yemimeka. So I am kel shakai, be fruitful, multiply, nation, assembly of nations will come from you, umilachim mechalatzecha yetzeu. Kings will come out from you. Pasuk Yud Beis, ves haaretz, Hashem osati l'Abraham l'Yitzak l'cho et nena ulezarecha acharecha atenas haaretz. And also the giving of the land. So the substance of these two brachas is very similar. He's promised that he will have many descendants, he'll promise that the land will be given to him and to his descendants. However, should we ask to which of these two brachas is Yaakov, by us in Parshas Vayechi, referring to, it's very clearly the second one, when he comes back in Parshas Vayishlach. And the way that we know that is because there are numerous similarities or parallels that exist between Yaakov's words and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words there. In Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov begins by saying, Kel Shakai Nir'ah Elai Beluz. He refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Kel Shakai. And in Vayishlach there, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, the Pasuk begins, Vayomer lo Elokim, Ani Kel Shakai. So clearly that's a signature that links these two events. Moreover, Yaakov says, Hashem said to me in Pasuk Dalet, Vayomer Elai, Hineni Mafracha Vihirbisicha. I will mafracha, make you fruitful, virbisicha, multiply you. Mafracha virbisicha is essentially a rendition, back again in Vayishlach, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ani Kel Shakai, Perei Urevei. Perei Urevei became Hineni Mafracha virbisicha. So clearly again, the reference is to Vayishlach. Moreover, as Yaakov says in Vayichi, in Pasuk Gimel, Hashem appeared to me, Beluz Be'eretz Kanan, Vayivorech Osi, and blessed me. Now between the two episodes, one in Vayetze and the second in Vayishlach, it is only the second which says, in Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Tes, Vayira Elokim El Yaakov Od Bevomi Padan Aram, Vayivorech Oso. And the Pasuk states that Hashem blessed Yaakov. When Yaakov says, Vayivorech Osi, that's a reference again to Vayivorech Oso. So it's becoming clearer and clearer that Yaakov is referring to this second event of Parshas Vayishlach. And this brings us to the final connection, and that's the one that we need to inspect a little bit deeper. Namely, Yaakov says in Pasuk, Dalet Vayomer Elai, Hineni Mafrecha V'Hibisicha. As we said, I'll make you fruitful, multiply. Unesaticha likal amim. I will make you into an assembly of nations. Do we find that Hashem said, Unesaticha likal amim, an assembly of nations? Well, back to Perek Lamed Hei, in the end of Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, again, Ani kel shakai, perei urevei, goy ukahal goyim yihiyem mimeka. So a nation and an assembly of nations will come from you. So in fact, this aspect that Yaakov mentions, that Hashem said to him, Unasaticha lekhalamim, is a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words, Goy ukahal goyim. However, at this point, the similarity bears out the difference. Namely, we cannot help but notice, Yaakov quotes, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, Nesaticha lekehal amim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that he would make him into kehal goyim. Now Yaakov is clearly referring to those words. The question, of course, would be, why would he change? Why would he misquote, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words? Of course, we need to ask the question, what's the difference between kehal goyim and kehal amim? I mean, they sound largely the same. A goy and an am are two words for nation, but they're not the same. They're not identical. Why would Yaakov change? That's a good shaila. We've come this far. And it's clearly referring to that, but he paraphrases, so to speak. Why? Says Rav Hyman, the answer to this question as to why Yaakov, so to speak, deviated from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words, from Vayishlach to Vayechi, is to be found before Vayechi, and before Vayishlach, and before Vayetze. The answer to all of this will be found in the end of Parshas Toldos. And when we look now at the final section of Parshas Toldos, it will be with new eyes. We refer to Bereishis Perek Kafches Pasuk Beis. So Yitzchak calls Yaakov, he doesn't want him marrying from Benos Canaan, and says, Kum Lech Padena Aram, Beis Abasul Abi Yimecha, so go to Padan Aram, go to Lavan, Vekach Lecha Misham Misham, Ibnos Lavan Achi Yimecha, and take a wife from there. Vekel Shakai Yivarechoscha. Kel Shakai will bless you. Vyafracha Vyarbecha. And will make you fruitful and multiply you. V'hayisa lekehal amim. And make you an assembly of nations. So Yitzchak here, I think once we've seen the rest of Chumash Bereishis, these words take on an entirely new significance. This is not merely Yitzchak giving Yaakov a bracha. Hashem yivarech otcha, Hashem will bless you. He's not just blessing Yaakov in that way. He is foretelling that at a certain point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as Kel Shakai, will bless you, and V'yafrecha V'yabecha, and V'yisela Kalamim. So this is a nevuah, really, for Yitzchak saying to Yaakov, at a certain point in the future, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bless you with the following, which he did in Parshas Vayishlach. So the first reference we have to the bracha in Parshas Vayishlach is actually through Yitzchak's words in the end of Parshas Toldos. And we note that as much as we have the familiar markers, Kel Shakai, Yivarechoscha, V'yafrecha V'yabecha, but he concludes, V'hayisa lekehal amim. The very first reference to this bracha is actually that the bracha will be lekehal amim. Now, if that's true, then in a sense, Yaakov now is reaching back as he refers to this episode where Hashem blessed him, but he does so not in the terms that were said to him, but in Yitzchak's terms. It's very interesting. Yitzchak foretold the bracha will be Vayisel Kalamim. In the event, the bracha was Kahal Goyim. But as Yaakov goes back over that episode and recalls it, he recalls it not as it was, Kahal Goyim, but as Yitzchak said it would be, Kahal Amin. This is very interesting. Why would he do that? Indeed, Rashi comments in Parshas Vayishlach as to why the word Goyim is used as opposed to Kahal Amin. We're not going to get into the details. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, shifted from the way that Yitzchak said that it would be, even though he's not bound to the way Yitzchak said it would be, but the original formula was predicted as Kahal Amim. Hashem changed it, so to speak, to Kahal Goyim for various reasons that Rashi speaks about in Parshas Vayishlach. But Yaakov is looking to reestablish his connection to Yitzchak's foretelling of the bracha more than the bracha itself. Why? The answer, says Rav Hyman, is because there is one fundamental difference, significant difference between the bracha as Yitzchak said it, and the bracha foretold it, and the bracha as HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it. Namely, by the time HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses Yaakov, Vayisa lekehal goyim, and kehal goyim means, as Rashi says, that one of your sons will actually become an assembly. That means that some of your grandchildren will actually have the status of the Shvatim themselves. The question, of course, is who? who will be the Kahal Goyim? Well, in Parshas Vayishlach, Yaakov is already married to four wives. So it's a 1 in 4. And it could be Rachel, but it could be Leah. And Reuven was born first. And Yosef was born last of the firstborns. Difficult to know. But if you want to know the answer as to who the bracha refers to, go back to the way Yitzchak said it. Because in the preceding pasuk, in the end of Toldos, before he says, Vekel Shakayiv Arechoscha, etc., he said, as we mentioned in Pasuk Beis, Kum Lech Padena Aram, Beis Abasul Avi Yimecha, go to Padena Aram, Vekach Lecha Misham Isha, Mibnos Lavan Achi Yimecha. Take a wife. What that means is the difference, in a sense, between Yitzhak's foretelling of the bracha and when the bracha actually happened is when Yitzhak foretold it, he did so in terms of Yaakov only marrying one woman. Vekach lecha misham isha. Now, who is that one? Well, if there's one, it's going to be Rachel, because she was the one that Yaakov wanted to marry. In the event other things happened and he ended up with four wives. But the isha misham is without a doubt Rachel. And therefore, as surely as originally Yaakov was only intending or intended to marry one wife, and still there accrued to him the bracha of Kahal Amim, that tells us that from whom will come the Kahal Amim? From that Isha, namely from Rachel. That's more definitive from Yitzchak's nusach of the bracha than it is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's, so to speak. Because in the time that Hashem came to give the bracha, Yaakov has four wives. But the way Yitzchak, when he already predicted the bracha, it's only with Yaakov as having one wife. And therefore, says Rav Hyman, we understand why on this occasion Yaakov is looking to quote the bracha more closely to the way Yitzchak said it than the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it. That is to say, in order to establish that whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu said ultimately was along the lines that Yitzchak had foretold. And the upshot of all of this is that if there are any grandchildren who are to be upgraded, so to speak, or promoted to Shevet status, they're going to come from the way Yitzchak already has given us the window to understand that it's from the one Isha, namely from Rachel. And that leads Yaakov to Yosef. It will be Yosef's children. And that is why, after Pasuk Gimel and Pasuk Dalet, if we could formulate it this way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha with the Yitzchak Avinu overtones, that is clearly to establish that which are the grandchildren that will become Shvatim? The children of Yosef. And thus, the very next Pasuk concludes, Ve'ata, and now, Shnei Banecha, your two sons, will become like my two sons. And now means based on the above. Once we've established that the bracha was intended for my children from Rachel, that's you, you're the oldest from Rachel, Be'atah, and therefore Ephraim and Manasseh, your two sons, will be like my two sons. So this is really a sweeping insight. These psukim, the nuances, are only fully appreciated, the Parshas Vayechi, when we take into account also Parshas Toldos and Parshas Vayishlach and Parshas Vayetze, and the whole thing is in front of us, then we get an understanding of what Yaakov is saying. Interestingly, just a word about the bracha to Menashe and Ephraim. Of course, it's the most famous image from Parshas Vayechi when Yaakov crosses over his hands. And that's referred to in Pasuk Yudalet, Precious Perek Memches Pasuk Yudalet. Vayishlach Yisrael es Yemino, Vayoshes al Rosh Ephraim v'hu hatzair. So Yaakov, he reaches over his right hand onto Ephraim, even though he's younger. Ves Smolo Rosh Menashe, his left hand on Menashe. Sikel es Yadav, we would translate Sikel. He switched his hands over. Ki Menashe abachor. From Menashe's the Bechor. Now, many Mefarshim raise the question, Rishonim and Achronim, how can we read the second half of the Pasuk in a straight line? It says, Sikel es Yadav, he switched his hands, Ki Menashe Bechor, because Menashe's the Bechor. The words Ki Menashe Bechor are hardly an explanation as to why he switched his hands. On the contrary, because Menashe is the Bechor, we need an explanation as to why he switched his hands. But the question became the answer. But it's still the question. I mean, we haven't answered it just by substituting an exclamation mark for a question mark. I mean, the question is still there. This is the problem. Menashe is the Bechor. How can that be the answer? That's why he switched his hands. That's the question. And this is something that we've discussed on a number of occasions. The Malbim has a very fascinating insight. A number of years ago, I was on the way back from Chutz La'aretz. It was the middle of the night on the plane. I had the Malbim to keep me company, and this is actually from that journey, the one thing I remember. The right hand represents the ikar of the bracha, that we know. Yamin, the yamin is the ikar. It's for that very reason that when a person blesses with two hands, the Zohar Kodesh says that the right hand should be raised slightly higher than the left hand. Interestingly, as far as I understand it, well, I mean, I've seen this, naturally, of course, only out of the corner of my eye, but there are certain kohanim, their minhag is when they duchen, the right hand is raised somewhat higher than the left hand. That's the way it should be. In keeping with the nature of the right hand, if it's the ikur, it should also be the higher hand. That's the norm. What does that have to do with us? Says the Malbim. Let's read the pasuk. Again, it says, "Vayishlach Yisrael es yemino." So Yaakov sent over his right hand, "Vayoshes al rosh Ephraim." What's it? He put on Ephraim's head. He's the younger. "Vesmolo al rosh Menashe," and his left hand on Menashe. What's interesting is, if he chose to give Ephraim the right hand, so the right hand has been given to Ephraim, but he put his right hand on Ephraim first, and then he put his left hand on Menashe. That means that there's actually been, aside from the reversal of the hands, there's also a reversal of the relationship between the right and the left, because the right should always be on top, which means that he should have put his left hand out first, because then when he puts his right hand, it's on top of the left. But by putting his right hand out first, the left hand becomes the upper hand, and that is a departure from the norm. How are we to explain this? That's a good shayla. Says the Malbim, and many Mefarshim have take this approach in general, it is not categorically true. It is not absolutely true that Ephraim attained eminence in every area over Menashe. In certain areas he did, in the more ruchnius areas, as represented by Yehoshua, etc. But there are many areas, politically and militarily, etc., that Menashe Dafka remained dominant. How can this be accounted for? Did Ephraim not get the right hand? Doesn't that mean, I mean, there are only two hands, it's either right or left, doesn't that mean that Ephraim is dominant in every respect? Says the Malbim, no. Because actually the way the brachas came through the right and the left, to borrow the expression, it's a mixed blessing. In the sense that it is true that Ephraim got the right hand, but the right hand should normally be the upper hand. Here it was the lower hand. And what that means is that Menashe, as much as he got the left, but he got the upper left. And that registered in certain aspects of dominance or preeminence remaining with Menashe, as much as others came. In other words, Ephraim may have gotten the Yamin, but Menashe retained the upper hand. And the Malbim is more inclined to translate the word Sikeles Yadav, not as to switch, but rather from the word Seichel, which is actually, I believe, how Unkelus translates. Ach Keminun, Chochma. He acted wisely with his hands. What's so wise about switching your hands? You know, the wisdom was that he was able to give Ephraim the right hand while still retaining an element of upperness, of superiority for Menashe. Sikeles Yadav. And why did he do that? Ki Menashe ha-Bechor, because Menashe, at the end of the day, is the Bechor. and therefore there are certain aspects of preeminence that naturally accrue to him, he shouldn't be deprived of. And therefore, ki Menashe Bechor is the explanation, not why Yaakov switched his hands, but why he switched his hands in this rather more involved way to for Menashe to retain those things that were his due as the Bechor. So that's a classic comment of the Malbim on Menashe and Ephraim. And from there, I'd like to take a look just for a few moments at one of the psukim of the Brachos. I think normally we focus on Reuven, Shimon, and Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda. By the time you finish with those four, it's already Higiyas, Mankriya, Shema, Shel, Shachris, and we never really have time for the others, and some of them are just one pasuk. But at least to address, even on a basic level, some of the issues to start to foray into the other Shvatim. So I'd like to take a look at the bracha of Zevulun. He has one pasuk bracha in Perek Memtes, pasuk Yud Gimel. Well, what does Yaakov say to Zevulun? Zevulun, lechof yamim yishko. He will dwell by the coast. V'hu lechof aniyos, and he will be by the where the ships are. V'yakasoa al Tzidon, and his lot will extend to Tzidon. So what do we know about Zevulun now? That he dwells by the coast and he's involved in shipping. More than that, we don't know. Mefarshim raise an interesting shaila. The first part of the bracha does not seem to be particularly distinctive. For it says, he will dwell lechof yamim. Lechof yamim means on the coast. Zevulun was not the only tribe whose portion was on the coast. Anyone who's on the west, spanning the entire north to south of Israel, is on the coast. It's one of their borders. So how do we understand that this is something said specifically about Zevulun, where it's true of another number of Shvatim? Indeed, al derech ha-pashtus, there are those who say that the first phrase is not yet distinctive for Zevulun. Zevulun lives lechof yamim, so do others. But the point is that unlike the others, Zevulun, this is his calling. This is his vocation, to be involved in Chof Yamim. In other words, the balance really is the realization of his geographical location. V'hu l'chof aniyos. This will be his specialty, the imports and the exports and the shipping, and that's really where he comes into his own. But indeed, the opening phrase is true of another couple of Shvatim, but v'hu l'chof aniyos, that's where he comes into his own. Okay. The Torah Tamimah has an interesting comment to make, and that is, the pasuk says, "Zevulun lechof yamim yishkon." He will dwell by the coast of seas, lechof yamim. Now, how many seas is he? Does his portion have a coast with? There's only one sea to the west. That's the Mediterranean. It's one. There are many seas in the world, but his coast is only the coast of that sea. So why is the plural used? Says the Torah Tamimah, actually Zevulun, unlike the others, has a border with two seas. Because on the west, it is the Mediterranean. But on the east, inland, there's another sea. That's the Yam Kinneret. The Kinneret is referred to as a Yam in the Torah. And that is in the portion of Zevulun. And this indeed is unique to Zevulun. There are others, maybe more to the north, more to the south, who are also on the Chof, but they're Lechof Yam. They're on the coast of the sea. Zevulun is the only one who's actually lechof yamim. He's bordered on two sides by the sea. So that's the very interesting comment of the Torah Tamimah. A third possibility is really to ask the question, what is the word chof? Which is an interesting shaila. We're used to it. What is the chof? Chof yam. Chof is the beach. It's the seashore. It's the coast. But why is it the seashore? I mean, why does the word chof mean that? And here, actually, Rishonim, the Baalei Haloshon, are divided. Why does the word chof mean what it means? Well, the Rashbam explains that the word chof comes from the word chofef. And chofef means to be aside, something else, like chofef alav kol hayom in Parshas Vezos HaBracha. And therefore, the sea and the land, the coast is where they're chofef each other. They're constantly side by side in that way. And therefore, it refers to any coast, the word chof and the word chofef. The Radak, interestingly, has a different translation of the word chof. For Radak, it does not refer to any coast from the word chofef, but actually it refers to an inlet or a bay. Chof Yamim is not a seashore. Chof Yamim is a sea bay. And what's the point, says Radak? It comes from the word chofeh or chupa. That is to say, it covers or protects. Chof is not just land that is adjacent to the sea. It's land that forms an inlet which protects a certain body of water. And that's ideal for shipping. The ships cannot dock by the seashore. They dock in a bay because they need that protected inlet structure. And that is unique to the portion of Zevulun. So, interesting difference of approaches to this question of what we mean when we say Zevulun lechof yamim, in terms of how the parts of the pasuk relate to each other, and ultimately even what the word chof itself means. Okay, Rashi comments famously on Zevulun that his shipping pursuits were in service of a higher calling, actually. He has the famous relationship with Yisachar, the Yisachar-Zevulun relationship, where he supports Yisachar, and then he has a portion in his learning. This is the arrangement that they had. Rashi says, Shaya Zevulun, Osek bepakmatia. Zevulun was involved in business pursuits. Umamtzi mazon leshevet Yisachar. Yisachar were famous as Torah scholars, and Zevulun would support them. Vehemos gematera. And Husha Amar Moshe, and this is similarly resonates with what Moshe said in his brachas in Vezos HaBracha, Smach Zevulun b'tzeisecha v'Yisachar b'ohalecha. I mean, Moshe connects the two in the same bracha. Zevulun goes out, Yisachar's in the ohel. That's their arrangement. Zevulun yotzei b'pakmatia v'Yisachar osek b'tora b'ohalim. So Zevulun is involved in business, Yisachar is learning, and they have this partnership. This is well known to us, I believe. Yisachar and Zevulun, it's a trademark name. The question that Mefarshei Rashi are seeking to answer is, why does Rashi tell us this? That is to say, the pasuk is more or less understood, and once you've worked out what's Chof Yamim, what's Onios, Yakoso Al Tzidon, nowhere does the pasuk give an indication as to anything beyond what Zevulun is doing. Why does Rashi, therefore, in the context of his comments on this pasuk, see it as appropriate or necessary to tell us why Zevulun is doing this and about this relationship he has with Yisachar, Yisachar's learning, and Zevulun is working? Well, the Mizrahi implies that Rashi is actually coming to answer a question. Namely, so far, the brachas have been in order of the age of the children. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Those are the first four. Next comes Zevulun. Zevulun is not number five. He's number six, even of Bnei Leah. Yisachar is number five. Good Shaila. Yisachar's next. And the next pasuk will be Yisachar or Chamor Garim. But already there's a bit of a question because there's been a deviation from the order. How come we went from number four to number six and then back to number five? Why does Zevulun come before Yisachar? And the answer to that is, says Rashi, because Yisachar is only realizing his bracha as a result of the efforts of Zevulun, and therefore Zevulun comes first. In the words of the Medrash Tanchuma, Gadol ha-me'aseh yoter min ha-oseh. The one who gets the whole thing going, he has a certain eminence. as surely as Moshe himself said, Smach Zevulun b'tzeisecha v'yusachar b'ohalecha. He mentioned Zevulun first, even though Yusachar was older. And in other aspects, Yusachar does come first. Chanukas HaNesiim, which we spoke about just last week in Parshas Noso, Yusachar comes before Zevulun. But in this instance, Zevulun comes first. But in order to understand why, you need to appreciate their relationship with each other. So that's the explanation of the Mizrahi. Interestingly, the Nachlas Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Selnik, one of the classic Mefarshei Rashi, he's unhappy with this Peirush of the Mizrahi for two reasons. Two rather different reasons. First, he says, Nachlas Yaakov, if Rashi is explaining the background to the relationship of Yisachar and Zevulun because he's bothered by the deviation from the order as we have anticipated it, then we have a problem. Because Rashi has explained matters here. But what about the rest of the Shvatim? The rest of the brachos also, the rest of the brachos do not seem to follow any order. That is to say, who is after Yisachar? Dan. And then Gad. After him, Asher, then Naphtali. That's no order that we've ever seen. Now, obviously, there's an explanation, but Rashi doesn't talk about it. So why would Rashi not see as necessary or relevant to discuss the order of those Shvatim? Apparently, it's not something that Rashi's getting involved in, but if he's not getting involved in it later on, why would he specifically choose the Vulad and Yisachar to answer one of the deviations if he's not going to deal with all of them? That's a good shaila. Moreover, says Nachlas Yaakov, there's a further Rashi point here. And that is, if indeed Rashi's goal here is to explain the deviation of the order, he would not have put this comment at the end of his Dibur, which discusses the words Zevulun Lechof Yamim. Because Zevulun Lechof Yamim, Rashi begins by explaining what the word Chof means, and what's Chof Aniyos. Those are explanation, explaining words. This is a separate question altogether. Why is Zevulun before Yisachar? This sort of thing, says Nachlas Yaakov, if it's coming to address a different issue, not the meaning of the word, but rather the order of the brachas, it would have found itself in a separate Dibur of Rashi. But actually, it's the end of Rashi's explanation of Chof Yamim. And these are the two questions, difficulties that Nachlas Yaakov raises on the Mizrahi. And that is why he suggests, or he understands, that Rashi is bothered by something else. The reason why he comes to give this explanation as to what the goal of Zevulun's shipping pursuits are, is because otherwise, what type of a bracha is this? As if to say, all of the other brachas, they seem to refer to some significant characteristic of that shevet, whoever it may be, Malchus and Kahuna, or some attribute. Shipping is not an attribute. It's a profession, but as a bracha from Yaakov, it's rather pale. That is to say, Reuven has these sorts of issues that he needs to work with, Shimon and Levi have these, Yehuda will be the melech, Zevulun, he'll go into the shipping business. That's it. And Rashi's bothered by this. For that, he needs Yaakov. Let Zevulun decide what he wants to do. And if he has an aptitude for it, but that's all he got from Parshas Vayechi, is it okay to go into shipping? And that's why Rashi's saying, understand the relationship between Zevulun and Yisachar. There's something very great going on here. Because Zevulun's his pursuits in that area are what will enable him to have this partnership with Yisachar, and that's really the full measure of his bracha from Yaakov. So this is a very interesting approach from the Nachlas Yaakov to Rashi's words there. So those are some insights with regards to the bracha of Zevulun, and Mitz Hashem, leave the others for a different occasion. I'd like to now move towards the end of the parsha, when Yaakov is already passed away, been buried, and the brothers come back in Perek Nun, Pasuk Tesvav. It's a very difficult group of psukim here. Vayiru achei Yosef ki meis avim. So the Yosef's brother saw the father had died, and they were frightened. Vayomru lu yistameinu Yosef. Maybe now Yosef will finally take revenge. Perhaps he will bear a grudge against us. Vashev yashiv lanu eis kol hashira shegamalnu oso. Maybe he'll finally give us our comeuppance. And therefore, Vayitzavu al Yosef lemor, they sent a message saying, Avicha tzivalet neimo so lemor. They sent a message to Yosef saying that Yaakov said the following before he died. Kotomur le Yosef, tell Yosef the following. Ana sana pesha achecha v'hatosam ki rogam alucha. Please, this is Yosef talking, Yaakov talking to Yosef. This is the message. Please bear the sin of your brothers. Even though they did bad to you. And then the brothers themselves conclude, Va'ata sana lepesha avde elokei avicha, and they add their own plea, similar in substance. Please bear our sin, Vayef Yosef v'tabra. And Yosef cries when he hears all of this. Now, what we need to know about this episode is that, about this message, is that it never happened. Yaakov never said this. The brothers fabricated it. Rashi tells us. It's from the Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Samachay. They felt it was Pikuach Nefesh. They had no idea what Yosef was planning to do with them, and therefore they tried to help things by creating a message, Ki'ilu, from Yaakov, saying that before the father died, he said, say the following to Yosef. Don't, you know, bear their sin. Why didn't Yaakov say this directly to Yosef? Don't know. Well, because he never said it. but they felt they had no choice. Pikuach nefesh. Interesting, if we take a look closer now at this pasuk Yud Zayin. First they quote the message, the virtual message from Yaakov. Say the following to Yosef. Ana sana pesha achecha v'chatosam ki ra'og malucha. Bear their sin, and then the brothers say, V'ata sana lepesha v'delo ki avicha. Please bear our sin. Similar, they're reiterating Yosef's words, pardon me, Yaakov's virtual words. However, there are one or two differences. The words that they ascribe to Yaakov in the beginning of the pasuk say, please bear pesha achecha v'chatosam. The pesha, see, however we translate that, the wrongdoing, the iniquity, v'chatosam, and the sin. When the brothers submit their own plea, they say, sana lepesha avdei elokei b'cha. Pesha, only pesha, no chatosam. What's the difference between referring to whatever happened as pesha v'chatosam or just pesha by itself? Go China. Secondly, Yaakov refers to the brothers as your brothers. Sana pesha achecha, bear the sin of achecha, you Yosef, your brothers. The brothers don't refer to themselves as Yosef's brothers. Rather, they say sana lepesha avdei elokei avicha, to the servants of the God of your father. But they don't say brothers. And because these two messages, they're so similar to each other, again, these differences are very striking. And this is a matter that's discussed in the Sefer Kometz HaMincha, the Droshes of Rav Aaron Troy of Munich. And he explains as follows. If someone is guilty or accused of something, so the accused typically has two ways that he can relate to the accusation against him. He can either admit it and plead guilty. And if he does, so how will that help him? Maybe at the very least he pleaded guilty and asked for clemency, maybe a pardon or the like. Or he can plead not guilty. That is to say, he can defend himself. He can justify himself. Those two, of course, are antithetical. He's either in the right or in the wrong. And that will, of course, is always the question. How do you plead? It's either guilty or not guilty. They're two different avenues. Which avenue do the brothers take here? Do they plead guilty to the crime of selling Yosef or not guilty? So interestingly, in this situation, they take both courses. But how can they take both courses? They're only one group. True, but they do have at their disposal a fabricated message from Yaakov, which means actually there can be two, not only reinforcing the same message, there are actually two rather different types of message here. That is to say, in their own name, they plead guilty. But in Yaakov's name, they defend themselves through this virtual message from Yaakov. What does that mean? We know that the difference in connotation between the word pesha and chet is that pesha has a very iniquitous connotation to it. There's something very wrong. It's practically inexcusable. Chet has a connotation of something that's unintentional. And normally it refers to a shogeg. Didn't mean it badly. Perhaps wasn't so bad. The brothers, as they ask Yosef to be nice to them, they refer to their dealings with him only as pesha, as if to say they don't try and soften what they did, they don't try and mitigate what they did, they don't try and downplay it. It was a pesha, beginning to end, we admit it, that's that. And that's why they can't refer to themselves, they don't and can't refer to themselves as your brothers. They can't say, please have mercy on your brothers. Because the problem is, the issue is that they as brothers didn't have mercy on him. So mentioning their brother relationship won't help them here. Because that's, well, to use the halachic terminology, en kategor, nasa senegor. The accusation can't become the defense. They can't say, you know, we're brothers, how could you do this to us? Because that actually reawakens the question, well, how could you have done it to me? We're brothers! And therefore they refer to themselves in a much more different direction. Avdei Elokei Avicha, we're God-fearing people, we're doing our best, etc. But they don't mention that brother aspect. But in Yaakov's mouth, right, from Yaakov can say, Bechol zot they're your brothers, and therefore in his words they say, Son of the Pesha, Achecha. But moreover, as much as the brothers, from their part, the plea coming from them direct, they make no attempt to cover up or excuse anything, but through Yaakov's words, they do. There's a parallel message here. Namely, Yaakov said, please bear their sin, pesha v'chatosam. In other words, part of what they're doing is they're using the vehicle of this virtual message from Yaakov to express to Yosef, vicariously through this Yaakov message, that maybe he should understand what they did. That's very interesting. There's some aspect of defending them, or explaining them, or justifying them. It's a pesha, but maybe it was also a chet. Maybe it's not that bad. How can it not be that bad? Because, again, through Yaakov's ki'ilu message, they're saying that if they spontaneously had initiated this aggression against Yosef, that's inexcusable. But they didn't. Perhaps they misjudged the best way to react to aggression that they perceived on Yosef's part. Yosef had been spreading bad reports about them, and they saw themselves as being sidelined, and as the many Mepharshim explain, why they took such drastic action. It didn't begin in a vacuum. They reacted, and maybe they overreacted, but it was a reaction. And if they overreacted, maybe it wasn't so much a pesha, maybe it was a chet. Maybe they did what they thought they had to do. And what's fascinating is the expression that's used in this pasuk, again in Yaakov's speech bubble, Ana sana pesha achecha v'chatosam ki ra'ah gemalucha. Now again, the word ki is interesting because it's hardly an explanation. Why should you forgive them? Because they were terrible to you. It doesn't sound like a good explanation. But it says, the Komitz HaMincha, consider the word Gemalucha. What does it mean? We would perhaps, I think the translation is they wrought evil unto you. They did evil unto you. They bestowed evil unto you. But the word Ligmol actually doesn't mean to do or to bestow. It means to repay. Gomel. It means to repay. As if to say, this is, it's a very delicate defense that the brothers are setting up here for themselves. Don't be angry at them. Bear their sin. And maybe it's not as bad as you thought. Why? Because everything they did as gemul. They were reacting to you. So maybe don't judge them so harshly. Maybe they overreacted. But consider your role. That's really what they're saying. And they can afford to do this because it's in the mouth of Yaakov, who's no longer here. So this now becomes the two-pronged approach of the brothers. From their own mouths, they're admitting only guilt. But we just want to communicate a message from Yaakov, who asks you to consider that maybe we're not as guilty as otherwise would seem. We didn't act against you. We reacted against you. Very interesting. Now Yosef's response to all of this, at least initially it says in the end of Pasuk Yudzayin, Vayefki Yosef b'davram elav. Yosef, he cried. Why does he cry? The Komitz HaMincha asks this question, but all the Farshim do. Why is he crying? Well, I mean, Yosef has cried a number of times. It's a highly, highly emotionally fraught episode here. And perhaps it was due to emotion. Perhaps, as the Komitz HaMincha, he cried because he was so upset that they suspected him of perhaps wanting to seek revenge against them at this time. He was so, you know, mortified by that. There is perhaps a third explanation. Komitz HaMincha doesn't say this, but based on his words, perhaps. And if it's incorrect, I retract in advance. But according to the Komitz HaMincha, the brothers are at least floating an idea to Yosef that whatever they did was a reaction to things that they felt he was incorrect as doing. And maybe that's why Yosef is crying. In other words, maybe Yosef is considering that to some degree they're right. That is to say, maybe he was also in the wrong. On this, you know, just looking back now that it's all over. So, Vayefki Yosef b'davram elav. So that is perhaps part of the equation here. So these are the classic comments of the Komitz HaMincha. This pasuk, I mean, it's so much in it. There's two messages, and to understand exactly the relative role of each of those messages. Now, Parshas Vayechi ends with the passing of Yosef. That's the final pasuk. Vayomas Yosef ben Mi'aves Hashanim. So Yosef died. That's the end of Parshas Vayechi. Interestingly, the way that Chumash Bereishis ends is also the way that Chumash Shemos begins. Because towards the very beginning of Chumash Shemos, we find Vayamas Yosef v'cholecha v'cholodorahu. So Yosef's passing is mentioned again, first at the end of Bereishis, and again at the beginning of Shemos. Interesting. I mean, it only happened once, but it's mentioned twice. Rav Huttner has a very profound, as is his way, comment on this matter. Chumash Bereishis is the formational sefer. It's the Chumash HaYetzira. It's the sefer of creation. That's why it has the Avos, because the Avos are the formation of the Jewish people. And who are the Avos? Well, Ein Koren Avos Ela L'Shlosha, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They're the Avos. Beyond that, Bonim. So the division is pretty clear. However, we should know that if we look into the matter, we will see that there is one transitional figure. Someone who is, in a sense, on a border. He is one of the sons, but he has much in common. He has properties of a father as well. And that is Yosef. Interestingly, Yosef is referred to within the brachos, Yaakov's brachos in Perek Memtes, Misham Ro'eh, Evan Yisrael. He's referred to as the rock of Israel, Evan Yisrael. Rashi says the word Evan is a contracted form of the words Av and Ben. Yosef is Av and Ben. What does that mean? Sometimes we have these, as one era ends and the other begins, there's something in the middle as a transition. Well, how does this express itself? In the beginning of the Parsha, Ephraim and Manasseh become Shvatim. So from a certain point of view, Yaakov reaches past Yosef. Yosef is his son, and now Ephraim and Manasseh are his son. So Yosef has been pushed to the side, and now that gap has been closed. But says Rav Huttner, consider, Yaakov is the father of Shvatim. His sons are Shvatim. Yosef is also the father of Shvatim. Manasseh and Ephraim. The father of Shvatim is an Av. But if we look into it, we will note there are details here, but it's not in every aspect or with regards to everything that Manasseh and Ephraim are considered Shvatim. In some respects they are Shvatim, in some respects they're not. They have their own Degel, they have each one has their own Nachla, but in other respects it's Yosef. They band together to be Yosef. And what that means is that Yosef is not categorically an Av. He is in some capacities an Av, in some capacities a Ben. That's why his own children are in some capacities Shvatim, and in other capacities, Yaakov's grandchildren, like everyone else. We mentioned that Sefer Bereishis is the Sefer of the Avos. It's the Sefer that encapsulates the Avos. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they're to be found in Bereishis. That encapsulates their lives. Well, what about Yosef? Is he encapsulated by Sefer Bereishis? The answer is yes and no. That is to say, his death is recorded at the end of Bereishis, which means he's entirely contained. That makes him like one of the Avos. But then his death is recorded again in the beginning of Shemos along with the other brothers. And that reflects the aspect of Yosef that's like the other brothers. And he's not entirely contained within Chumash Bereishis. It's very interesting to see how this resonates in other areas. The Torah in Hilchos Rosh Chodesh and Siman Tav Yud Zayin draws an equation between the three regalim, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos, and the three Avos. And there's much to discuss about each of the connections. Pesach is Avram. Avram has his famous Achnosos Orchim on Erev Pesach. And Yitzchak is Shavuos, the shofar of Matan Torah, was from the ram of Yitzchak. And Yaakov is Sukkos. Sukkos appears for the first time in Parshas Vayishlach, the word Sukkos in connection with Yaakov. Yaakov Nosa Sukkosa. And that's that. There's only three regalim. There's only three Avos. And that's the end. However, there is another regel, kind of. That's Shmini Atzeres. The end of Sukkos. So the eighth day, Shmini Atzeres. What is it? Is it a new regel? Is it a continuation of Sukkos? Well, the answer again is it depends. With regards to certain things, it's its own regel. We make Shechianu on Shmini Atzeres. We do not make Shechianu on the seventh day of Pesach because it's the seventh day of Pesach. But Shmini Atzeres is not the eighth day of Sukkos. It's Shmini Atzeres. It's a new regel. You make Shechianu. But in other respects, it's still considered to be a continuation of Sukkos. Says Rav Huttner, that corresponds to Yosef. Because once again, it has this dual nature that Yosef has. In some respects, it's its own. In other respects, it's a continuation of that which came before. Just to conclude with one emanation of the Av status of Yosef, because there's a certain property that accrues to Avos. We say Masa Avos Simen Labonim. That means the experiences of the Avos, they allow for the experiences of the children. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov have this the whole time. Yosef also has it, but on a slightly different level, because his Masa Avos actually lead into the Simen Labonim. Because the first of the Jews to experience difficulties in Egypt was Yosef. He's sold as a slave, and he starts at the bottom, and he works his way up. And Yosef, maintaining his integrity, actually paves the way for the Jewish people. Him as an individual, he spearheads the Jewish experience in Mitzrayim. Indeed, this is the understanding of the Yerushalmi in the 10th parak of Maseches Psachim, which discusses the Arba Kosos, four cups of wine on Seder night. Why do we have four cups of wine on Seder night? Well, depending on how you are, some people don't ask too many questions of that sort. But for those that are interested, why are there four cups of wine on Seder night? That, of course, is the four Lashonos of Geula. That's also in the Yerushalmi. But the Yerushalmi says, the four cups of wine on Seder night correspond to the four times the word kos is mentioned in the butler's dream in Parshas Vayeshev. Kos paro yodi, vatim betocha kos, put the kos on the... What's the butler's dream got to do with Seder night? Have we got enough else going on Seder night that the butler had a dream and we've got a... And everyone all of a sudden got four cups of wine? My Indian butler ate it till Seder night. So the Mefarshim explain, the butler's dream is the beginning of Seder night. Because this was the turning point for Yosef. Yosef until now has had nothing but sorrows. The dream of the butler is a turning point. His interpretation ultimately leads him to rise. And therefore, the four cups represent, on an individual level, the beginnings of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of emergence to freedom and in Mitzrayim. That's the explanation that's given. That's the element of Maisa Avos within Yosef. His personal experiences pave the way for the Jewish people. I would add a hargosha. I don't know what else to call it, but it's very interesting that we find the four cups of the butler's dream find their way onto the Seder table. But there was another dream, which is also part of the equation. That's the baker. What did the baker have in his dream? He had three baskets of bread on his head. Seder night is the only time in the entire year that we have three levels of bread, one on top of the other. Those are the three matzahs. Every other time it's Lechem Mishneh. I don't know what to make of that, but I do notice that it's there, and I wonder whether it's connected, because now both dreams are there. The four cups and the three layers of the bread, it's the two dreams together that got Yosef ultimately out of prison, and which led to the Jewish people ultimately to leaving Mitzrayim, which is celebrated on Seder night. Chazak, chazak, finish. I'll take, we'll leave it over there for this evening.